would you call yourself a socialist?
No.
You've never told a lie in politics?
No.
See, somebody sent me a video action last Friday and it had you talking at the socialist union.
Yes.
And you mentioned the word comrade about four times in a minute. What was that about?
It was a rally and I would have been about 25 years old.
Comrade.
That was in 2009.
Oh, well, I can't remember which country it was in.
Has it changed since those days?
No, not particularly.
If you are caught in a lie or caught intentionally misleading the New Zealand public, how would you expect to be held to account?
Well, I actually believe that it is possible to exist in politics without lying.
We drum in that messaging around the dangers of COVID pretty diligently for a full two-week period of sustained propaganda.
I've got my friend Zachary Humphrey.
Oh, yeah.
He's an emergency room nurse. And I was asking him about remdesivir, and I wanted to have him on the show, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so we wanted to draw you into the conversation, brother, about your experiences in the emergency rooms with COVID patients or anything else that you have liberty to share about. But specifically, we were Grant and I were talking earlier about remdesivir. And how, because I've, you know, J.R. Newmiller, I don't know if you knew that brother or not, but he was a street preacher that recently took a turn so quickly. In a few weeks, he's now died, and he was hospitalized. And I don't know specifically if remdesivir was given to him or not, but we were talking about, and maybe you could confirm or clarify our understanding or misunderstanding, that remdesivir is kind of the go-to COVID treatment for people that are coming in. People that have pneumonia or bronchitis or maybe even TB, because all those conditions have gone away with COVID now. If you have any kind of respiratory illness, it's COVID, and therefore they would treat you with remdesivir instead of treating you with normal antibiotics, which would be curative in past medical recent history. Your thoughts, brother?
Yes. Yeah, so I have actually worked exclusively on COVID units throughout the pandemic, or what they're calling a pandemic. And in my experience working on these units, remdesivir, Velcory, is the most common antiviral being given in the treatment of COVID-19. In fact, remdesivir was the first drug approved by the FDA. While they disapproved of hydroxychloroquine, they did approve of Velcory or this remdesivir for treating COVID-19 patients. And we know, I don't know the type of audience your guys' following has, but we know the Food and Drug Administration is corrupt. I believe that anyways, that they are corrupt. And we know that Dr. Fauci was promoting remdesivir where he was not promoting hydroxychloroquine. And we know how that was politicized, and even hydroxychloroquine factories were burned down in America. And surprisingly, you know, they burned down. And so that's been the most common treatment. And so regarding your comment, I just thought that was interesting when I learned that was the first one approved, because it fit their narrative. And one thing I can say, I have not seen for myself where remdesivir has been the reason for which a patient seemed to improve from their COVID-19 symptoms. And some of that is hard. I'll play the devil's advocate for a moment and say that there's a lot of factors that goes into someone's recovery or failure to recover when it comes to any illness. And so I can't say outright that if someone doesn't improve who had remdesivir, that it was because they had remdesivir they didn't recover or did recover. That's very difficult. On the premise of remdesivir, they say that it's an antiviral that keeps the virus from reproducing in the body. And so typically when you get diagnosed with COVID-19, they will give you a 5 to 7 day trial of remdesivir. And you'll get 1 to 2 doses per day, and you will be admitted to the hospital. if your symptoms are bad enough to be admitted to the hospital, then you would get a remdesivir treatment. These remdesivir treatments, if they're unsuccessful, they may extend that treatment from 7 days to 10 days. If a patient isn't improving by day 10, day 12, day 13, a lot of times you see those patients start to go downhill from that point. If they don't recover from the remdesivir treatment, then their other option, which not all states are doing this to my knowledge, and there's a limited quantity of it, but the monoclonal antibodies for COVID-19. So antibodies that have been recovered from people who had COVID and recovered will be then infused into people who also have COVID-19 as a form of recovery. We have seen, I think, from my nursing perspective, a better recovery rate with the monoclonal antibodies versus remdesivir as an antiviral. But even patients who have received hydroxychloroquine, who have received remdesivir, who have received these monoclonal antibodies, some of them do not recover. And we see them develop COVID pneumonia. And the latter is you, if you're starting to do worse, you develop pneumonia, and these patients will typically get antibiotics that are common for pneumonia. They may get something like cefepime or vancomycin. They'll receive, usually you'll see them receive other antibiotics because antivirals will not treat pneumonia. Right. But so the antiviral, the remdesivir, is to treat the pneumonia, to treat COVID-19. If the patient develops an extensive case of pneumonia, they'll receive antibacterial medications like cefepime, vancomycin, antibiotics in order to try to treat that pneumonia they're developing. If the patient does not recover, they can end up on a machine called a BiPAP. It blows air into the lungs, causing them to inflate, and then it will pull the air out, causing them to deflate, which helps the patient to oxygenate. As the patient is doing poorly, their lungs will not be able to keep up with the demands of oxygen their body needs, and they won't be able to breathe through all the mucus in their lungs. If that is occurring and continues to get worse, then they may end up on a ventilator. And I can say from personal experience that we're looking, I would even argue, in the death rate of the 90s percentile, somewhere in the 90s, if you end up on a ventilator from COVID-19 symptoms. I will say that outright. Now, this has been an argument of many that is the ventilator better or worse? Should they be being put on ventilators? When COVID-19 first started, a lot of these doctors were very jumpy. They were putting people on ventilators that really weren't meeting the standards yet for needing ventilation. So they were still breathing good enough on their own. They didn't need to be intubated. But the thought process was, is the patients are they're decompensating so quickly, the only way to preserve life is to go ahead and intubate the patient. And what was happening was intubation is a traumatic thing. I mean, it may be used to save life, but it's also very damaging. It has been argued by some ICU nurses and others who don't fit the narrative that they want to push on the medical world that ventilators have been misused and have caused death in COVID-19 treatment. However, there does come a time in the treatment of a COVID patient, if they are doing poorly, when the only way to maintain life at this point is to intubate the patient. And at that point, intubation does make sense. But treatments have become less aggressive, like less jumpy, I should say, than what they were, as people have become more used to it in a way. But that's kind of been my perspective of COVID treatment. I know that hydroxychloroquine is a antibiotic I'm seeing more of now. Really, it's like an antiparasitic agent along with ivermectin. And I was talking to someone the other day that ivermectin, I said, oh, that horse antibiotic. And he said, no, brother, it's not a horse antibiotic. It is an antibiotic, which is used in the treatment of horses. But that doesn't mean that it can't be used in the treatment of human beings, which has been shown to be effective in the treatment of COVID-19.
I think ivermectin in horses is used against, it's like a spirochete. I think it's not a antibiotic. It's a, you know, when you've got a, like a worm. It's like a worm, and it's known as a worming medicine, but it's a particular worm that attacks the heart of horses. But yeah, it gets used as a human medication as well.
Right, and I think the reason they don't like the use of things like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine boils down to one thing: money. Yeah. Ivermectin can be purchased without a prescription at a horse place like Bowling's Hardware or some kind of store that does hardware and farming materials. It's not strictly regulated by some big bully like the FDA. And as well as hydroxychloroquine, which is also a very cheap alternative to more expensive treatments. Typically what I've seen as really effective when I see doctors giving these medications out at an early enough point when someone has COVID, because there comes a time when we're past the point when hydroxychloroquine may or may not be enough to maintain life because they're already struggling to breathe enough as it is. Yeah. If you can catch a patient who has COVID-19 early enough, azithromycin or a Z-Pak, high doses of vitamin C, zinc, and vitamin D3, along with hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin in the place of hydroxychloroquine, has been a very good combination in seeing recovery of patients who have COVID-19 symptoms. So that has been the consistent thing that I've seen, and all of those medications are very cheap. And so it's a regulated world, as we all know, and it is a business. And I hate to say, but I think there were some very corrupt people who became rich off this whole thing. One thing that I'm running into, I can say from my medical perspective here, is I've been given an ultimatum in my job that I have to submit my reason for which I do not have the COVID-19 vaccine by September the 10th, and then I am due to have it by October 1st. Of course, they're saying between September 10th and October 1st, they're going to consider my position, which I'm going at this based off a religious exemption, which in America, and especially throughout this process, doesn't seem to matter much to them anymore. But I have a very clear case from our denomination's perspective on the use of fetal cells and aborted baby cells in all of these different vaccines. And so within like my church denomination, we have very specific clauses against our consent of such medications since it promotes the death of babies. And so I have a very clear position from a organized denomination for which I'm refusing this shot, but I'm expecting that not to matter to them anyways. So I'm not really sure how they will about ignoring or agreeing with that proposal, but I do appreciate any prayers or wisdom on your side as well for that situation.
Well, how about I send over the GP letter. Now you can adjust it. You can just put in the stuff about, you know, these are the questions that I want to ask about it, because I believe also it would hold in the United States that anybody acting under an authority, like a authority of an act of parliament, or what do they call them, in title such and such or so and so, acting under a title, okay, they have to do so in good faith, right? Now, if they then look at the if they have to look at the evidence of, you know, the fact that there's many, you know, about just looking at the medication itself, or the whatever they're calling it, the vax itself, the testing, has it got instructions in the box, etc., etc. There's many, many things, but I've whittled it down to four main questions for the doctor, and then invoke patient-doctor confidentiality and get them to back off. I understand completely what you're saying about you should be able to rely on your religious exemption, but as these people are ruthless, they are not.
Yes.
Well, they believe that the Antichrist is going to come and make it all right, okay? And it'll be all right with the world that they envisage. They don't think we're going to win. But so a little bit of subterfuge, if you like, so the doctor doesn't have to come out and agree. They just have to look at their own situation, because they're going to be, and this is the truth, and I believe the truth is that they are going to be put in a position of crimes against humanity. Once, because they're turning a blind eye. This is the problem. They refuse. They actually refuse to look at the evidence what this vaccination can do to people, can kill
and
people.
And I have personally witnessed in my line of work the amount of people coming into the hospital with COVID-19 from the shot damage.
Yeah. Wow.
Has been extensive. I have seen multitudes of patients with various negative reactions to these shots. Oh. In fact, I mean, very, very, very frequently, I would say every week that I've been working, I take care of multiple people who are there because they just had the Moderna, or they just had the Pfizer, or they just had the AstraZeneca, and they are coming into the facility with various ailments they never had before. And that is a very common occurrence, but you're not hearing that from doctors. You're not hearing that on the news. You're not hearing that from the established organizations, but we are seeing very common people coming in with various ailments and illnesses from those shots. So you're very correct that these have been crimes against the world, and I hope that they are held accountable.
They will be. But in terms of your own situation, why not go into the belly of the beast with your letter and say, you now must look at it because I'm here as your patient. You have a duty of care to look at it, okay? So then they can't turn around. Then that puts them into a position of what I call guilty knowledge, okay? They cannot act in good faith if they then go ahead and recommend it, okay? So not only would you would be saved, but also they will know from here on in that they have guilty knowledge. Because they have to be forced to look. They have to have their eyes propped open with matchsticks, if you like. Because how they're getting out of it is they're saying, I didn't know. And this is what the Nuremberg trials.
Right.
We hear a lot about the the leaders, the gang, the leaders, and sovereign immunity had to be overcome for the Nuremberg trials, actually. Because in the past, before the Nuremberg trials, heads of government and heads of ministries, etc., they couldn't be tried for war crimes. They had to develop actual new law, right, in the Nuremberg trials. Lawyers don't seem to get that either, but that is the case. So, but there were many, many doctors and bureaucrats and people lower down the pecking order who were tried as well. There were thousands of trials, but the problem was that the Nuremberg process kind of they didn't have enough money. Now that is not going to be the case in our new Nuremberg, because of course, everybody can be tried at home, if you like, or tried in their own country. They don't have to be taken, you know, and there doesn't have to be a whole lot of money spent. All of these tribunals can actually happen in the country of the criminals. So we are going to get every one of them this time, because the last time, many, many of them got away, you know, and they went to places like the paperclip operation in the United States. We got
paperclips. George Soros.
We got some of them here, right? So we're still suffering from the effects of Nazi Germany. We're still suffering, yes. You know, from these criminals just going on and on and on. And then they have children, and they teach the same sorts of beliefs and you know, and the same techniques to their children. You've got whole families of them.
Yeah.
Proper rat's nest. But yeah, from your point of view, Joshua, Zachary. I'm very happy to send you the example of the GP letter that I just completed yesterday, you know, with the newest suggestion that the doctor now does a prescription, does treat the patient. So I would say be proactive. Don't, you know, get it done as quickly as possible. So then, you know, it's off your mind. And it's exactly. And it's no business of your employer what's happened within the confines of your consulting, the doctor's consulting room. Do you remember that you, of course, all know the story of Schindler's List, right?
Yes.
This is a technique that Schindler used, right? He had all sorts of creative solutions for making sure that he complied with what the Nazis were telling him to do, but he did that in a creative way that stopped them going to the gas chambers.
Mm.
That's what we're trying to do.
Right.
Completely moral.
And so I wanted to interject one thing there, Liz. First, I would like to connect the two of you with email. And so sure. I'll endeavor to do that after the show tonight or early tomorrow. I did want to comment about what Zachary was saying about the numbers of people coming in for COVID shot related conditions. And our VAER systems, the Vaccine Adverse Emergency Reporting System, is reporting over 14,000 deaths and 600,000 plus severe injuries, however you define that. And there was an Oxford University study about 5 years ago that found that the VAER system in America only reports about 1% of what's actually happening. So if we surmise that that's true, then 99% of the deaths that are occurring from the COVID shots are more on the matter of about 1.3 million people. And those millions of people that are dying are just being misdiagnosed in their deaths. So it was COVID that they supposedly died from, but actually it was the COVID shot.
Well, this is what you're running into in the medical world, is that the patient comes in presenting with these symptoms. The doctor who is over the patient has to be willing to acknowledge the fact that patient had their shot X amount of days ago. And if he doesn't willingly ask the patient that question, then he's and doesn't willingly gather that information, then he won't fill out the VAERS reporting system. And because so many of them are unwilling to acknowledge that the vaccine could hurt anybody, they are not in any way, shape, or form. And this has been true from all the different vaccines throughout time. They will not prove this information because they don't believe it's possible.
Yeah, that's been
because it's some paperwork that you're the paper that you're talking about. The paperwork is in every ER, or should be in every ER in all over the world. It's regulation. But whether or not you fill it out is really up to the individual physician. And that discrepancy that for you here, that look at a patient's medical chart, they have changed the medical charting system. And for us in America, a large charting system is called Epic. And that's where you have your medical fixed chart and updated it recently throughout the COVID thing. To the left of the charting system, there's a very bold section, the important stuff you need to see right away. And some of the top things you're going to see there is the patient's name, their date of birth, the day they were admitted, and what they were admitted for. But they have added right there under their name their COVID-19 vaccination status. And that status right there will tell you when they were vaccinated.
Can we get Zachary to, Zachary, can we, sorry to interrupt.
And so,
Zach, can we get you to go out and come back in again? Because we're just having trouble with your connection. If you could just cut yourself off and then come straight back.
Yeah, sure. So is this better? Let's see here. So what we're seeing is to the left of the patient's charting system, this is true for every person, that under their name, it says their COVID vaccinations coming in with medications now, 19 things they know is when or if you have or have not had a COVID-19 shot of whatever brand it was. So if someone's coming in with these negative symptoms within such a period of time of that shot, the physician should be held liable for not filling out a VAERS reporting system. That would be a breach of his duty as a medical doctor alone. Physicians are doing, and millions of reports are not being filed. Right. And that's a breach of their duty. That's one of the things they're required to fill out, just like any other paperwork they're supposed to fill out. So I can vouch for what John was saying. I would say the percentage is astronomically low for what's being reported. And unfortunately, a lot of that is due to the physicians just not wanting to acknowledge that there's a potential link.
Yes, well, not wanting to do something is going to be no excuse, actually. Now, perhaps that should be made clear. Maybe people need to know a bit more about the Nuremberg trials and what sort of defences were put up by people like doctors and people like bureaucrats, etc. Apparently, coercion was one of the things that were put up. So people worrying about, I'll lose my job. I have old people at home that I need to provide money for, etc., etc., etc. Apparently, that was never pretty much accepted. Unless you had a gun held to your head and said, you do this, those doctors are not going to be able to call on, well, we didn't think it was important. That is not going to be an excuse. I think there must be a way that they need to be made aware that to not report death or injury and link it into the COVID-19 status, vaccination status, will be pivotal in their defence or lack of defence when the time comes. I don't know how to do that, but I think it would be a simple thing to do, but you know, how to do it is another thing.
Can I address that, Liz? Because I had a bit of brilliance about a week or so ago for a moment. And in that, Zachary, I encourage you to do this as well. I had written to one of our senators, Senator Rand Paul, and I showed him Title 43, subparagraph 300AA, that says it's a federal United States code, and Grant has confirmed that you all have something similar there, and I'm sure probably every nation has this type of law. This federal code, United States code, says vaccine manufacturers have no civil liability for litigation regarding vaccine injuries or deaths. That's it. That's all it says. And so I was telling Mr. Rand, the Honorable Senator Rand, Mr. Rand, if we can get this thing repealed, off the books and open up the courts against all the vaccine manufacturing injuries and deaths that's been occurring. This law was put in place in 1988, Liz. Uh-huh. 1988. That's a lot of litigation. That's a lot of problems. And I was first telling Grant earlier, I was first made aware of vaccine problems watching the well-done documentary called Vaxxed, V-A-X-X-E-D. And there's a second one similar to it as well. But so this has been many years ago that we stopped giving vaccines to our children. And my last vaccine was the anthrax in the military before Desert Storm. But so if we this linchpin, so to speak, of removing this law from the books will open the floodgates for many people throughout the nations that are so legally, morally frustrated by what seems to be everybody's ineptitude or ability to deal with what we know is morally wrong and reprehensible, that we jab these little babies with poisons and that's supposed to be good for them. And now that the adults are being threatened with getting jabbed, everybody's freaked out about it. Well, where were we 30 years ago when the babies were getting 50 or 70 jabs before they're 3 years old? How we're treating babies like pincushions with this sorcery. And where were we, the watchman on the wall, so to speak, when we should have been warning everybody around us and the medical professionals, and excuse me, Zachary, I don't mean to offend you, but medical professionals not warning people about these dangers.
No, you're
so
correct.
I think that's a great strategy, legal strategy, sister. If you could find out what is that law in New Zealand and perhaps other countries and get politicians that are on our side, first thing we could do is, who ratified this thing? What are their names? I want their addresses, and I want to go protest in front of their house.
Well, we have ACC. We have this new thing called ACC, don't we, Liz?
Yeah, here's the thing. Our insurer is ACC, or Accident Compensation Commission or something.
Corporation,
yeah. Now, that came into being in 1973. Now, perhaps doctors think, and medical professionals think, that because it's what's called a no suing, we cannot sue for personal injury in New Zealand for anything, because our insurer will pay us out.
Horrendous,
and so there are no court cases, right? Mm. Now, ACC, there are a couple of, there are a couple of let-outs for people still to sue, and one of them is medical misadventure, okay? The other one is something like emotional damage, right, which sexual abuse survivors use, right? And ACC has to pay out for that. But ACC, you can sue on that. And so you can get something other than what ACC would pay out, you know, if you suffered some other sort of personal injury. Now, I think that they might have been a little bit slack in New Zealand and not remembering that there was that loophole. So I don't think we actually have a law in New Zealand that says you can't sue chemical manufacturers, pharmaceuticals.
There is a new one, Liz.
Pardon?
There's a new one. It was done last year. Particularly before, so right. Pfizer wouldn't release their vaccines to New Zealand without things they had to do. One was, if a new drug came up that was better than the vaccine, they weren't allowed to stop using the vaccine and go for the new drug. And secondly, the vaccine company is immune from prosecution. That was new.
Okay. So what we don't have to do, I mean, even if we couldn't get that removed, and it should be because it's a good one because people understand that, but what they the government is still in the firing line, and unfortunately that's our treasury that we're depleting by suing the government. But by suing doctors, sorry. The doctor themselves can be sued. Now, I think that is quite, because as you're saying, Zachary, it's actually individual doctors who are, you know, just whether they think that they're, you know, that people are just, you know, going to sue, you know, they can't be held accountable, if you like.
They're threatened, by the law society. Liz, yeah. They're threatened by the medical council, threatened with losing their license.
By medical council. Yeah, well, you know, we've been through that. What the hell use is your license if you're killing people? You're going to be in a prison cell. You're not going to have a license anymore. You know,
right.
getting the individual to wake up, the individual doctor, the person who actually puts the needle in the arm, that's who we've got to wake up, actually.
Well,
of the people are woken, but they can't stop this horror, this mad doctor sticking something in their arm at the moment.
And I feel like a lot of the challenges too is an acknowledgement of truth versus established error. The amount of pride exhibited, I can tell you, in the background, like let's say I'm working one day and a patient expresses doubt over taking the COVID-19 vaccine, and the doctor is in the nursing station and I'm there doing my charting and I overhear him talking about the patient. It is amazing to the extent of which these physicians act so arrogant towards legitimate questions or concerns that patients have, and they'll act very nice to your face, but in the background, I've heard doctors say, I'm tired of treating people who won't take the shot. If they won't take the shot, we should stop treating people who won't take the shot. And wow. I've heard physicians even say that in America. Just last week, there was a rather liberal group of physicians all across the country who were wanting to stage a walkout of the hospital because they were saying that not enough patients are taking the shot. And so we're just going to protest them by refusing to give them medical care. And we know this same line of logic is not followed when it comes to people who smoke cigarettes, because patients may smoke cigarettes, but we still treat them for cancer when it's developed. Or if someone destroys their liver with alcohol, we still treat their failing liver in their latter days, even though they did that to themselves. And so, you know, the line of logic related to the COVID thing has made a lot of physicians very, very, very proud, even when challenged. In fact, I overheard a conversation the other day between a nurse who was refusing the COVID-19 shot and a doctor. And it was amazing the amount of ifs, maybes, and we don't know for sures that physician said. But at the end of the conversation, he still said, it's still the best treatment against COVID-19. I still think it's been thoroughly studied and you should take it. And I was sitting back and thinking, after all the things he said that they didn't know for sure, he was still okay with putting his whole lifeline on the line to say to this woman, you should take it. And I feel like that is really a scary thing, to not allow the patient to have the freedom to question even. And that's where we're getting to over here, that I'm seeing that every day I work at the hospital.
But then they're thinking that science is their God, aren't they? They're thinking, yeah. Well, the science says, and the science says, and this is, you know, somebody who was as smart as me has said X, Y, Z, and the arrogance stems.
It's not really science, is it?
No, it's not. It's a personal arrogance in their own belief and that, you know, their intelligence and their position is all of their own doing. It's just complete arrogance. You know, it's like, who,
yeah, so
do they think gave them their intelligence?
So we have a Bible verse regarding false science in 1 Timothy chapter 6. And verse 20, it says, O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science falsely so called. So even back then, we have, 2,000 years ago, the Apostle Paul instructing Timothy about wasting your time opposing science falsely called. Now, you might object to that line of reasoning, but there it is, right there. Avoid profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science falsely called. So it could be any, science isn't just record, repeat, and theorize. Yeah, observe, record, repeat. But science is every area of knowledge, whether it's philosophy or legal knowledge or astronomical knowledge or whatever it might be. Science is either true or it's false. If it's examined under the light of truth, that is Jesus Christ and the Christian worldview, then we can start to get good foundations. That's the whole point of the passage.
Yes.
Very good. We're speaking with Zachary Humphrey, John McGlone, both from Kentucky, and Liz Lambert, who's from Waiheke Island in New Zealand, and I'm Grant Edwards, and you're listening to Liberty NZ. Fantastic. I'm really enjoying this. Let's keep going.
Okay.
Zach, you have more time?
I do, brother.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great.
Yeah. So, well, you know, as you say, science, the science of law. It's amazing that, you know, lawyers haven't been more to the fore on this whole thing, because they're supposed to be, you know, is it true or is it false? And have you got proof of that or do you not have proof of that? And yet they're still afraid, and they don't seem to trust their own profession, profession as in their own training, to you know, make a stand, really. But it's changing. It's changing. So I'm not losing hope in them altogether. But and of course I'm working with a couple of good ones now. But excuse me, but it was a case from 1933 to 1939. You know, I often say that the crematoriums, etc., and the concentration camps just didn't spring up one fine day in 1939. This all starts off in 1933, and it's the process of law that it's done by. That's the actual mechanism. It's done by law. And when I was in law school, one of the only things we talked about in terms of jurisprudence around the so-called law of the Nazis was it real law? And the answer was, well, maybe, maybe. There was never any questioning of, well, is it right? It cannot be law if it's wrong. If it's a morally wrong thing that you're doing, it cannot be law. But that was never introduced into the conversation. It's always lawyers, even though their thinking is trained to be look at right wrong, they don't bring a moral view to it, it seems. So I mean, Grant was talking, we were talking once, Grant, and weren't we saying we need a group of Christian lawyers?
Yeah, we do. We haven't got very many that'll step up and defend you, especially with free speech. Can I change tack just slightly? Zachary, I just wanted to get your opinion on mask wearing. At the very beginning of this last year, 18 months ago, we had Anthony Fauci come out and say, you know, you can wear a mask if you like, but it's not going to do you any good. Our Minister of, Director General of Health, Bloomfield, he came out and said, you know, well, you can wear a mask if you like, but it's not really going to do you much good. It won't protect you from the virus. But now they've all changed their tunes. Well, they changed it fairly early on. Why do you think they've changed that? Is it because there really is new information now that masks do help, or is it because they were told from on high? Is it more of a political thing?
It is a telling from on high without question. It's a political thing. It's a social hint that you're with the narrative. And I can say for myself that we frequently as nurses are taking our masks up and down in the nursing station. We will see doctors when they get in the nursing station or, and are away from the patient's rooms, they'll take their masks off because we're at work 12 hours a day. You can't sit with one of those things on your face for 12 hours a day. And you got to get some fresh oxygen in your lungs. And so, to be honest, the masks are up and down all day long from the medical staff. In fact, the other day, brother, and I know this is a side note, and I'm going to bring it back into why I'm saying this. I walked past the doctor's room where all of them are eating their lunch, and there was 50 of them in a room 20 by 20. There was no 6-foot social distancing. There was masks up and down all over the room as they were eating. But if you take them in that patient's room, by golly, they're going to preach to that patient to maintain 6-foot distance and wear the mask. And it's hard to imagine that level of cognitive dissonance, but but it is there in a very heavy way. And so
why do you think they don't see that, the hypocrisy in what they're doing?
I feel that it's not there for two reasons. Number one, they don't know the truth in general. And so I don't mean truth just related to scientific fact, but they have not been awakened to the reality of truth in their soul. They know a narrative, but they don't have self-knowledge of truth and error, right and wrong, as our sister was mentioning a second ago.
Wow.
And so there's a level of blindness that we know that the world has over its eyes as it sits presently in darkness. And that blindness will pervade all aspects of how they approach the world around them. And so you see them tripping and falling, and they don't know what at, and stumbling over things we easily see. And so a person who's willing to know the truth can receive more light. John 7:17, Jesus said, this is an example, if any man will do God's will, he will know of what I'm saying, whether I teach God's truth or whether I speak for myself. And what I'm mentioning that scripture for is because if we're willing to know the truth, then we will know the truth. But if we are unwilling to know the truth, then we won't know the truth. And so there's a level of willingness to knowing truth in itself. These people who graduated college to be our physicians and doctors were taught morality is relative. Morality doesn't exist. It's a social construct. They've been taught that truth doesn't even exist. Heck, we might even be living in a dream. And so their view of life, the world, society, all of it is very different from what we understand it as being enlightened, in my personal opinion, by the gospel of Jesus Christ primarily. We are willing to know the truth, even in things that don't pertain to religion. And because we have a willingness, the truth finds us and we find it. And so that is where I think the dissonance starts. It's they're having a hard time understanding the difference between narrative and truth and what they're told versus what is real. And I think that's a big thing that we're facing right now. And I can say from the mask personally, brother, the holes in that mask are not going to stop a virus. In fact, if you want protection from COVID-19 by breathing a mask, the minimum mask you need to be wearing is an N95 respirator. An N95 respirator will see some significant drop in exposure to viral particles, but nothing less than that will do any good whatsoever. And so it's very tragic to see people pushing something that doesn't do anything. And in fact, I think mask wearing may actually be increasing the problem at hand, because you are breathing in the viral particles, stick to the mask, then you breathe it in all day. Well, that increases your exposure. And plus the bacterial particles from our spit and things of that nature growing in the mask. It's very important for you guys, if you are wearing a mask or if you know someone who is, that they get rid of that mask and get surgical masks if they're going to be made to wear them, and wear a new one every day. Because if they're wearing the same one day in, day out, we have had people coming in with developing pneumonia that isn't COVID related, but is because they've been wearing the same mask for a month straight. And so it's very important that people know that if they're being made to wear a mask on their job site, they need to be getting a new one on a daily basis in order to avoid setting up those types of infections in their lungs, because it's a very real possibility.
That's good.
If I could comment there for a moment, brother, and that I watched some videos of three industrial hygienists. And these aren't folks that work on your teeth. These are folks that work in the industrial environment regarding safety apparatus, filtration devices, et cetera, air masks specifically. And all three of these ladies were very adamant that the masks are very harmful to all of us, especially children, because of things that you mentioned, Zachary, the limiting of oxygen, which is, I think, a condition called hypoxia.
Correct.
And recycling of carbon dioxide, which is hypercapnia. And those conditions parallel some of the symptoms that they're claiming COVID-19 is, the dizziness, the shortness of breath, all that type of stuff. We only have to look at a viral lab like Wuhan to see what they're wearing, where they have inline oxygen generators in a full suit to keep the viruses out of their system, right? And so we can know just from that system that they put in place to protect themselves that we're not going to protect ourselves with a 6-foot distance and wearing a silly mask. And I know probably maybe 20% of the people at our plant that took the first vaccine took it because they wanted to get the mask off. Now, that's short-sighted, that's shallow, that's silly, that's foolish, not well-researched, but that's what they did. And many of them are now regretting, because of the consequences of what they're dealing with, having taken the first shot. And thank God our plant's no longer administering shots in the plant for whatever reasons. The mask is a huge hindrance, where most of us are physically working. We'll go up and down 4 flights of stairs. I walk 10 miles a day doing physical things, lifting and moving stuff. And I'm not the only one. 90% of the plant's doing that kind of thing. The only people that aren't are the folks at the top that are sitting in their air-conditioned offices. So it's a problem worldwide in every workplace that these masks are also a social controlling issue, and Zach, you mentioned that as well, and it causes people to be fearful, and it makes them think that it's real. They see something that's real. Okay, this mask is really protecting us. Everybody's wearing it, so there must be a real danger. But that's not the case at all, not according to what they're being sold. So anyway, those are my thoughts on the mask, and I'll try to share those videos with you guys because they're a great resource. And we're fighting that at the local school board level because the Kentucky Board of Education is telling our local school boards, threatening them with a warrantless arrest if they or any of their teachers violate the mask order from them. Now, a little background on that is, Governor Beshear's unconstitutional orders, as found by the Kentucky Supreme Court just a few weeks ago, so he rescinded all of his COVID-19 orders, right? Because they weren't lawful in the first place. The Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, who happens to be a Republican and fighting for the right side of these things, has been fighting him on this for about a year now. And then we see the legislature has finally put in, listen, your orders are unconstitutional. You cannot exceed 30 days. And so when they all three of them said that, then he rescinded all the stuff. But now we have these little sanctuary problems within the government levels, in this case, the Kentucky Board of Education. And each one of those members need to know, listen, we are coming to talk to you, and your job is on the line unless you get these masks off our children, our grandchildren. Mm. My granddaughter has been taught that this thing is good for her when I know very well it's not good for her. She's robotically putting it on and off like I'm supposed to do this, Grandpa. What are you talking about? No, baby, you're supposed to be able to smile and drink or drink in the nice fresh oxygen and exhaust your what you need. And you have a little sneeze, have a little sneeze. Just cover your mouth and wash your hands like we've done for thousands of years, like the Bible tells us to do.
I'm absolutely sure that the people behind this mask idea have done studies on it. They know that it stops us communicating with each other. It stops us. It just, it psychologically just divides us.
It's very disturbing.
Yeah. You know, you try and smile at someone when you're going into a shop with them and on. I wore one for the first time last week, and I just felt so disconnected to the person I was talking to on the other side of the counter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Have you seen the Counterspin? I think it's episode 20. It's a 2-hour show, but the first part of it is really interesting in terms of the board of, you know, boards of trustees on schools. There was an interview with a guy called Glenn Schofsky, I think his name was. Anyway, if you look at episode 20 of Counterspin Media, it's on Rumble. You can see him presenting to the board of trustees at one of the high schools in New Zealand, and they've backed off. And so New Zealanders are now in quite good numbers, actually, approaching their board of trustees with liability, you know, threatening them with liability claims, etc., if they don't back off. So as far as I know, the high school that he presented to has not gone ahead with a vaccination program, and they're not talking about that. Wasn't talking about masks, because we didn't have children in school with masks in New Zealand. That hasn't been the case. Whether they'll try it, you know, in the future, I don't know. But
I'm sorry, Spencer, did you say episode 20?
Yeah, episode 20. Yeah.
Okay, got it. I'm gonna put a link in the chat there.
Yeah, I've actually got it.
Cool.
Is that the one where you're on it, Liz? It says practical solutions with Liz Lambert.
Yeah, I'm in the second half talking about. I am talking to him a little bit, but there's a good little video clip of somebody actually. It's
Glenn
not
Krosky.
Great. Glenn Krosky, that's him. Yeah. And he was a journalist, and he kind of got drummed out of the trade basically, because he's a financial commentator, you know, in one of the rather larger media corporations, if you like, in New Zealand. And they didn't like the comments that he was making about what was going on in the financial world over the last few years, and so he's pulled out of journalism. But you know, he's a very he's very good, and he put together a very good presentation. Yeah, and apparently, usually there's nobody at these boards of trustees hold their meetings, and he had to push to actually get seen, but about 40 people turned up as well to and all in this little room. It's a good watch. Yeah.
Thanks, Liz, that's great. John, I couldn't put the link in.
It would work really well, wouldn't it, because they're so worried about getting sued for everything.
Will you put that link up, John, because I for some reason I can't do it.
Yeah, I was just trying to do that too. I'm not able to do it either. But
yeah, I can't find the messenger side of it. Hang on, I know what I'll do. I'll go back to square one and open it up again. Here we go. I've got us. Okay, yeah, I'll drop it in now for Zachary.
Right. I really appreciate your time, I have to bid adieu and say goodnight to all of you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate each one of you. God bless you.
Thank you. So that's John McGlone from Kentucky, and we've got Zachary Humphrey. Is that correct, Zachary? Zachary.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me what your qualifications are as a nurse, Zachary?
I am a registered nurse with almost 8 years experience working in heart and vascular critical care, step down, neuro science care, home health care, COVID care. I have NIH certification for stroke care, and have kind of been in every part of the field. I've worked in mental health care for mentally unstable patients. I've kind of covered the whole gamut of medical practice for a lot of what is provided in Eastern Kentucky.
Right. So, and you're at the coalface with treating COVID patients at the moment, and you have been for the last 18 months.
Yes, I have consistently been involved in treating COVID patients throughout the entirety of this situation.
Wow. What hospital? Oh, you probably did not say. And Liz is a lawyer from Waiheke Island, which is a little island where all the rich people live. Off the coast of
and seeing everybody's putting their credentials, and I've also got a political studies degree, and I've also got a diploma in labor studies, which is basically what somebody like what's his name, Obama would have done to become a community organizer. I was as well as union lawyer, I was a union organizer. And actually, that's what I started off wanting to be before I went to university. So that diploma in labor studies gives you kind of the whole area of all sorts of things about labor history, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But yeah, so that's my area.
And John McGlone. John is a 22-year U.S. Navy veteran, a U.S. Navy veteran, and 16 years as a Navy navigator. And so, yep, that's John. And me, I've got nothing. I'm nobody. Oh, it's been great talking to you all, and I hope we can do this again. I'm really interested in getting information from you, Zach, as you bring it to us from what's actually happening in the hospitals now as we speak.
Absolutely, I'm fascinated. Absolutely,
that's great. You know, I was fascinated to hear that a room of what 20 by 20 and 50 doctors, none wearing masks, eating your lunch, and then go out and speak to patients saying, make sure you wear your mask, make sure you social distance. It's just like, it's crazy. I see craziness all around me.
I did 2 years of my registered nurses training.
Oh, yes,
as well, but
that's right.
The hierarchy. But when you were saying that, Zachary, I was thinking, yeah, well, actually, doctors don't know anything about, isolation technique. That was one of the things you learn as nurses, but you don't learn that doctors. Doctors don't learn that. It's because it's the nurses who actually have to make sure that the disease doesn't spread to anybody else in the hospital. So if you're working in, you have to do a part of that as your training. It was many, many years ago when I did mine, but there's a whole technique. And I thought at the time when they... it suddenly happened in New Zealand that we had a lockdown, and what's happening with the people who are arriving still, have they got buses to take them to the quarantine? Oh no, they're just being told to go home and self-isolate for 2 weeks. Well, there you go, right on the evening of the lockdown, the first lockdown. That was it. You know, they'd already broken quarantine right off the bat. And then we find out, of course, that our head of our medical, what's he called, our medical director, right, Ashley Bloomfield, to add insult to injury, his speciality is non-communicable diseases. Non-communicable.
Well, it's midnight for these guys, so we're going to let you go, get to bed. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad you had a joke before we went. Okay.
Thank you too, Liz. It's been great talking to you. So we're talking to Liz Lambert, John McClone, and Zachary Humphrey. And hope to talk to you all again soon. You're listening to Liberty NZ. My name's Grant Edwards. Thanks for joining us.